Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that doesn't take itself as seriously as each of us individually takes the movies we see. In that vein, sometimes we remove our critical caps, okay, never completely, and go see films that fall on the far side of art. That might apply to most Marvel films that get made, but it definitely does apply to director and co-screenwriter Taika Waititi's feature Thor: Love and Thunder. Same with the based-on-real-events study titled The Phantom of the Open, starring the great Mark Rylance. Let's begin this week's show by checking out a truly marvelous film. Excuse my poor impersonation of comic actor Billy Crystal's stylized impersonation of the late great McCardle Montalban. I would say, though, that Crystal might have fit right into any world that New Zealand-born filmmaker Taika Waititi might, fantasize. Following up on the humorous bent that the Marvel Studios has followed with Chris Hemsworth's more recent portrayals of the Norse god Thor, Waititi and co-screenwriter Jennifer Caton Robinson imagine a scenario in which Thor, fresh off his adventures with the Guardians of the Galaxy troupe, finds himself both battling a villain, played by Christian Bale, who is determined to kill all gods, and not completely comfortably reunited with the Earthwoman, Jane Foster, again played by Natalie Portman, who once broke his heart. Jane has her own backstory, which ends up providing Thor: Love and Thunder a tender, dare I say, moving subplot. But aside from all the CGI-heavy action, much of which we've seen before, the best part of the movie is how Waititi navigates between that sense of tenderness and the comedy, marked especially by bits delivered by the likes of Russell Crowe, who steals his scenes with a hilarious take on his role in Ridley Scott's Gladiator.
Well, I should lay my cards on the table before getting into my opinions of Thor: Love and Thunder, just out of fairness, because I kind of dragged my feet going into this one. I just have Marvel fatigue.
Taika Waititi,
I think, has overexposed himself a little bit, and I just, you know, wasn't really in the mood for it. I have a friend who's a Marvel completist, has seen every single one of these movies, has seen all the TV shows, told me, you know, this isn't one of the better ones. It's not as good as the last Thor, Thor Ragnarok, which Waititi also directed. But if you go in with low expectations, you might have a good time. So I went in with low expectations and I did not have a good time. This movie stinks. It's so
You're
bad.
So harsh.
Okay, you know what? I think it's fine. We're 30 movies almost into this. Yeah. These are the biggest movies in the world. They've pushed pretty much all of their filmmaking to the sidelines. Yeah. So I think it's okay. Also, it's written by an Oscar-winning screenwriter. So I think holding these to certain high standards is perfectly fine. Marvel will be okay because I'm ragging on it a little bit. I'll talk about some of the things that I liked that were kind of layups for me. I mean, you have the Guardians of the Galaxy cameoing at the beginning. I love them. You have a scenery-chewing Christian Bale. He's having a lot of fun. Russell Crowe's having a lot of fun. There's even a sequence in this that is shot entirely in black and white, which I want more black and white sequences in movies. There's a montage set to ABBA, which I like. Sweet Child of Mine is a good song.
Oh, yeah,
that's
yeah.
on the soundtrack.
Guns N' Roses
yeah.
throughout.
And that's basically the end of my list of compliments. I would kind of put this in the same camp as Wonder Woman 1984, which
Ooh, no.
had, yeah, it is that bad. It has some good ideas floating around in the sludge, and yet Waititi doesn't follow any of them to their logical conclusion. This whole movie feels like one long second act where nothing is set up so that it can pay off later. There are scenes that just appear to be missing, where I was thinking, how did they get here? Why are they doing this? Who even is this? I mean, the Natalie Portman character, you said she has kind of a moving backstory. I thought that was so badly misjudged and just didn't work for me at all. And her character actually feels kind of grafted onto this, even though I really like the idea of Thor's ex-girlfriend kind of basically trying to outmaneuver him. The best character in this movie is Thor's axe, which kind of has a mind of its own and is jealous of him because he still has feelings for, you know, his old hammer that Natalie Portman now possesses. So there's some cute little gags in here, but for the most part, man, I was really struggling to get through this. And I feel like these movies are being cranked out to such an absurd degree on this Marvel assembly line. Just a couple weeks ago, we talked about Doctor Strange 2, and now we have this. They really need to slow down, because this just feels so half-hearted and barely thought through and just not as funny as it should be. I wasn't in love with Thor Ragnarok, but it was a good time at the movies, and it had a lot of big laughs in it, and it was colorful, and Chris Hemsworth is just such a great casting choice for Thor, and I love turning him into kind of a dummy instead of, you know, a really stoic figure right out of mythology. So, yeah, huge squandered opportunity for me. I really did not like this.
I love it when you go all bad on these movies, because
even
course,
when he's wrong.
Right. What's my perspective? I mean, to my way of thinking, all these superhero movies are the same. And the only thing that separates them from one another is the degree of humor. And here, it's not the same sort of humor that we saw in previous films. But Chris Hemsworth is so gorgeous and so silly in this movie.
I mean,
that
everyone
alone,
in this movie is pretty, so I guess you have something to look at in that regard.
Yes, well, look at the list of things that you touted as being positives for this particular film. My big criticism is just 10 seconds of Loki, because Loki does make this franchise, in my opinion.
Yeah. I totally agree with you, Nathan, about the notion of all these things being cranked out on an assembly line. You're absolutely correct. And maybe they do need to slow down. But, you know, I'm going back. Let's go back to the rethinking of all these kind of superhero movies. Way back to Tim Burton's first Batman. I was really happy then when all these films started taking themselves, they became movies and films rather than just, you know, the 1960s version of Batman. And, you know, and then through the Avengers. But slowly I've been watching these movies become way, way too serious. And I feel like Heath Ledger's Joker. You know, why so serious? What I liked about Thor Love and Thunder is that it just makes fun of everything. It makes fun of relationships. It makes fun of love affairs. It makes fun of superheroes. It makes fun of all of it. And so I had a good time taking off my critical cap. I didn't have to look at this as anything that Bergman might have made.
Well, no, I'm not holding it to that standard either. Well, I'm holding it to the standards of the other Marvel movies. I'll hold it to the standards of the last Thor movie, and this isn't to the standards of the last Thor movie. Will you admit that at least?
Yes.
No.
I will.
No.
I will.
No.
I'll admit that,
no,
but that was different. It was intentionally different, in my opinion.
But I agree with you, Mary Pat. I mean, I have trouble telling one from the next, and that's because there's so many of them, and yet at the same time, they're so separated, each of these particular chapters. To tell you the truth, I can't even remember Thor Ragnarok. Well, we did a show in which a public show in which we talked about it.
We mostly liked it. And I want to compare Thor Love and Thunder to the last Marvel movie that we saw, which was Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Which was a terrible movie.
It wasn't a good movie, but it at least had flashes of style courtesy of the director, Sam Raimi. There were moments in that movie that had a wit and a strangeness and a morbidity that you don't normally get from these films, because directors' voices really come second to the voice of Marvel as, you know, an umbrella corporation.
Let's face it, when you're talking about Taika Waititi, you're not going to get morbidity. I mean, this is the guy who did a movie about Nazis with little children and made it into a comedy. So morbidity's out. It's just
And that's fine. I'm not trying to knock Thor Love and Thunder for not taking itself seriously enough, because it tries to shoehorn in a cancer subplot, which is just
I'm gonna give you that, because I don't think that worked.
It doesn't.
But some of the past tensions in these movies are, I admit, missing from Thor Love and Thunder, because I think it was the familial relationships that sort of fueled or drove some of the earlier incarnations of this particular film, the brother thing, the dad thing, and so forth. So that's missing. And I think
that's all gone. And, you know, a lot of the criticism has been, we've got to, we painted ourselves in a corner here. Where are we going to go? time to either completely reinvent this, and if you stayed, we stayed for one of the post-credit sequences, so we know that Hercules is coming. Mm-hmm. We didn't stay for the second one, which you can go on YouTube or anywhere and see it, and it's Natalie Portman going to Asgard?
Yeah, or Valhalla, or whatever.
So,
well, and just looking at this from a purely blockbuster angle, I'm thinking of the climax of this movie, because the whole plot is that there are these children that are kidnapped from New Asgard, as it's called. I wanted more of New Asgard, actually. I thought that was another one of the
clever
ideas.
Well, you might get that the next
go-around.
Yeah,
maybe be careful what you wish for. But these kids are kidnapped, and Thor and company are trying to go find them, and they finally meet up with Christian Bale's character, who looks like a reject from Mad Max Fury Road. And I mean, he's having a good time. I thought Christian Bale was good
actually
in this.
Very good.
Although the character could have been even more evil.
That's what I'm saying, is that he's more off bad screen guy for so long, and then the climax is shot in these ugly, flat, medium shots, and I had no idea what was going on, and the CGI just overtakes everything. Like I said, it's mostly actors kind of standing shoulder to shoulder in front of green screens most of the time, which good movies have been made out of that formula too. Good Marvel movies have been made out of this formula. But yeah, this just felt so stale. It felt like nobody involved in this had their heart in it, and that's what was missing from
well,
this one.
All right, that's an arguable point, but you know,
it's a very good point.
You're not always right, Nathan.
Well,
but
no.
At any rate, all three of us have a very different view of Thor: Love and Thunder.
And the most important thing is, if you see it in the movie theater, there's air conditioning.
And you can take a nap.
Yeah. Anyway, this is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Phantom of the Open. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Subscribe to your favorite public radio programs when you become a Spokane Public Radio sustainer, just like any news or entertainment service you use. But unlike those other services, you decide how much you want to pay. Set up an electronic fund transfer, and monthly installments will be withdrawn automatically from your account. Plus, you can start or stop your subscription at any time you want. As a sustainer, you help make your public radio station strong, and you never have to wonder when to renew. You're part of the community that sustains public radio. Phone 509-328-5729 during business hours, or go online to SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click the red donate button and start the process. Working together, we make our community a better place to work, play, and listen.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbrenner, and I discussed the Marvel Studios feature, Thor: Love and Thunder. Let's now move to The Phantom of the Open. If you're any kind of sports fan, you likely recognize how sometimes the whole scene, whether we're talking about the Olympics or merely a middle school basketball game, is presented just a little too seriously. If you listen to those who announce professional golf, for example, you might think that they're discussing world-shaking events instead of a bunch of rich guys knocking little balls hundreds of yards. That's one reason why The Phantom of the Open is so refreshing. Based on the real exploits of one working-class British guy named Maurice Gerald Flitcroft, who finagled his way into the qualifying tournament for the 1976 British Open, the film, starring Oscar-winning actor Mark Rylance, deflates golf's overweening sense of self-importance. It follows Flitcroft, a working-class crane operator, who decides to enter the Open, has to do so surreptitiously, and ends up shooting a 121, the highest score in the tournament's history. The movie version of Flitcroft may have little similarity with the real guy, truth in filmmaking always ranking second to dramatic effect, and sometimes director Craig Roberts gets a bit too cute with his fantasy sequences, but classically trained Rylance is fun to watch, as is Sally Hawkins, who portrays his Field of Dreams wife. And two, it's always amusing to see regular guys stick it to those from the upper crust who look down upon them.
Phantom of the Open is certainly a timely release because the Open Championship is held this weekend, perhaps as you are listening to this broadcast. And Dan, I think that you captured the essence of this small film. This is not, a summer blockbuster by any means.
It ain't Field of Dreams, yeah.
Yeah. But the performances by everyone involved, and you sort of downplayed the son's character, because not only do we have Morris Flitcroft, who I think Rylance plays maybe a little bit too sweetly. Everything I've read about the real Morris Flitcroft indicates that he was a bit more of a character and perhaps a con artist than is the portrayal in this film. But his two twin sons, for example, were international disco champions of all things. And so they show up in the movie, and I really liked the two boys. Sally
played by
Hawkins,
real-life twins Christian and Jonah Lease.
Okay, now we know. And so it is one of those strange set-in-time movies where you can see the sort of decline of, the working class in Great Britain. We have a few little snatches here and there of politicians such as Margaret Thatcher, like pronouncing the New Britain and so forth. And we see it play out in a way that's not going to help average people. And so I had a good time at this movie. If you watch golf or play any golf, and I just say I like to go out on the golf course with clubs, but I don't necessarily play golf. I mean, you can see that there are certain things that happen in this film that aren't realistic with respect to the actual game of golf. For example, grounding your club
in the bunker
and so forth. But it was a fun time. It's a little movie. And if you're prepared to sort of go into it with that expectation, I think you'll be well satisfied.
Well, I took golf lessons as a kid and was about as bad at the end of the lessons as I was at the beginning. I never got better. So watching Morris Flitcroft do his thing in Phantom of the Open, he's supposed to be like the world's worst golfer. That's the title he gets. He's better than I ever could.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of people could contend for that honor.
I would be so much worse than him. So, as far as I was concerned, he was making it happen. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this is in the same school as a movie we reviewed just last month, I think, The Duke, with
yes,
Jim Broadbent
exactly.
and Helen Mirren. It's set a little bit after that, but it's also about, it's this kind of kitchen sink British domestic drama that has kind of a wry sense of humor about it. It's about
social class implications. Yes,
and it's also about a guy who's gaming the system.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's breaking the rules and potentially the law, but it's kind of harmless. Like who is this hurting really in the long run? And we find out at the end that the real Morris Flitcroft conned his way into multiple golf tournaments over the years using various aliases, including my favorite, which is Arnold Palmtree. I really enjoyed that. And the director here is Craig Roberts, as you mentioned, who I didn't know until I looked this up on IMDb earlier, but is an actor, was in a movie as a kid called Submarine that I really liked, and was on the Netflix show Red Oaks for a few seasons. So I thought this was probably going to be directed by, like a Richard Curtis type, but this is a young guy making a movie about old people, and I thought that he did a good job with that. I agree with you about the fantasy sequences in The Phantom of the Open. It makes sense as a sort of a stylistic gambit because Morris himself is kind of – he's got his head in the stars. He's thinking of things that no one else would possibly ever think of, but it doesn't really go anywhere, and it doesn't really add very much. But I appreciated that it wasn't just a standard made-for-TV kind of thing. There is some style here. And the movie also felt like it was really set in the 70s. The actors that he chose really looked like they could be right out of the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
The musical choices, the clothing,
the hair,
everything.
The two disco boys.
The period detail is really good. And I think it goes from like late 60s to mid-80s, early 90s maybe. So there's quite a lot of time.
I wanted to address what you had to say, Mary Pat, about Mark Rylance's performance. I think you're right. I don't think you're faulting Rylance.
No, not at all.
He's too talented of an actor. I think that was the intention of the director, the filmmaker all along, because I don't think that the real Flitcroft was a dreamer. I don't think that he was, I think that he intentionally said, hey, man, I'm going to go do this and maybe I'll become famous. He has a famous quote. He says, I wanted to either you have fame or money, and I got one. And he got fame, a minor amount of fame. But one of the interesting things about the entire movie is that I guess it's one of the climaxes of the movies that he after years later, he gets invited, he and his whole family, to America to this golf club in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And that actually did happen. They had a Morris Flitcroft annual tournament for bad golfers. You know? So,
see, Nathan, you know, there's a place for you
All. And if your name has to go down in history, I guess it doesn't really matter what it's applied to.
Yeah,
well,
really.
We've proven that repeatedly as of late.
I used to play in a golf tournament for the Spokesman Review sports department called the Wet Dog Fur Open, and there was a little tournament trophy for the best team, but my pride was getting that tournament for the worst team.
Yes, yeah. I have to say that we've talked about a lot of corny sports movies on the show.
Cheesy sports movies.
And this is one of them. There are moments in the third act of The Phantom of the Open that I thought were really kind of cringy a little bit because, I mean, it's just like, this obviously didn't happen this way. It's, you know, they're amping this up for ultimate
and
kind
Reese
of saccharine.
Fiennes character, the chair.
He does
the
all the
royal
twirl
and
his
ancient
mustache.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
That was a little extreme, but it was funny. And full disclosure here, we had the opportunity a couple of years ago to go to the Open in Carnoustie, Scotland, and it did sort of capture the flavor of what we experienced because golf right now is in this position, putting the Saudi back tour aside, where it's trying to appeal to a broader range of participants and so forth. So it's trying to discard, in some ways, its sort of snooty past and reputation.
Yeah, well, certainly in the United States, where idiots yell out, "You the man!"
In the hole.
That does not happen in Britain. You know, we did not see it once.
Right. So I think that having this broader appeal, you know, it still has these arcane and nitpicky rules that people will never understand or appreciate fully. But, you know, the opportunity to go out and play nine holes quickly, the opportunity to sort of wear the attire that you choose, you know, all these things I think will make golf more appealing to the masses, even if people don't improve after their lessons.
Well, and going back to Mark Rylance, because, you know, he is the centerpiece of the Phantom of the Open, I was worried at the beginning. I thought, oh, are we going to get another quote-unquote Mark Rylance performance? You know, he's kind of, you know, avoiding eye contact and kind of talking under his breath the way that he does. But I came to really like his performance and once I kind of understood what he was doing. I wish Sally Hawkins had a little bit more to do, but, you know, she's so charming. And yeah, this is a minor movie. It's a small movie of small pleasures. And I think really what it merits is a very polite golf clap. Like, that's about the level of quality. That
absolutely. It's absolutely right.
It is playing at the Magic Lantern right now. Mm-hmm. Again, can I say air conditioning?
Yeah. And that was our discussion of The Phantom of the Open. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed Thor, Love, and Thunder. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from none other than Taika Waititi himself, and Nathan will love this. I constantly remind myself that there are terrible movies out there. I try to watch them, some of them, to give myself an understanding of what not to do. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.